did.
I was in tune.
No, it was typical.
Four children.
We're going to open the Senate Education Committee today, February 28th, 2016. Sadly, for this year, is the last day of the month. But for other
that's
years,
a good thing.
Oh, is that a good thing today?
It gets us closer to sine die.
Oh, okay. That being said, we have some business to take care of. And the first thing, we're going to open a public hearing. And
okay, this one here.
Possible work session. But we'll go with a public hearing for HCR 18. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator and a wonderful opportunity to see the other chair of an education committee in the building.
Chair Rowland, members of the committee, HCR 18 recognizes March 3rd, 2017 as National Speech and Debate Education Day.
Okay. Representative Doherty, I didn't want to demote you too much.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, I'm Margaret Doherty, and I'm the House representative for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And I'm here today actually in place of Representative Susan McLean from Hillsboro. She is ill today, but this is her bill, and it's one that I wholeheartedly support because, like Representative McLean, I was also a speech and debate teacher and coach. In my younger years. In fact, just for my information, when I was in college, I used to debate against a very, very good debater named Susan Butcher, who happens now to be Representative Susan McLean. So we go back a few years. But with this bill, which, by the way, passed our committee 9-0, and it also passed the House 57-0, it designates March 3rd as the National Speech and Debate Day. The United States Senate resolution encourages education institutions, businesses, communities, and civic organizations, and all citizens to celebrate and promote National Speech and Debate Day. I think we all know how important being an excellent speaker is. And if you go through and judge any of the debate tournaments that are going on now, it never ceases to amaze me how bright the students are that are debating in the state of Oregon. And not only that, but there are a lot of them. And so I think it's very, very important when you have good speaking skills, when you've got the critical thinking skills that we teach to debaters, and when they go through and are able to be able to either think on their feet, be able to answer questions, be able to research, and to be very, very knowledgeable about the topics that they are, I think it's very important. Oregon has a very robust speech and debate program all over the state. Representative McLean, after 42 years of teaching, still is coaching the students at Glencoe High School and spends a lot of her weekends after being here all week at speech tournaments. So I would encourage you to pass HCR 18. And what it is at the bottom line, it says, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon that we, the members of the 79th Legislative Assembly, recognize March 3rd, 2017 as National Speech and Debate Education Day. Over for questions.
Any questions?
Just a comment, Ms. Chair. Mm-hmm. I also debated, and it's a wonderful experience. I mean, it's beyond belief what you can gain from that sort of activity.
And I'll just make, I'll pile on since I'm here. My son, all of my kids took debate in high school. It was kind of a requirement in the family because it made it better to have conversations at dinner when they all had equal skills. And our oldest went to nationals in high school and in college in debate. And when I did an extra interview with him at Marshall High School when he was graduating about what were the two most important things he did while he was in high school, he said, it's pretty easy, football and forensics or debate. And he said, football, I got to know there was a whole lot of other people in this school that I didn't know before because they weren't in classes with me, and their talents were as equally as important as mine, and we had to work together to make it happen. And forensics taught me I don't need teachers or anybody else. I'm responsible for my own learning because any debate topic, I was going to know more than the teacher because they didn't care about the debate topic, and I did. So once you learn the skills to know how to get information wherever you are, and once you acknowledge that you have to be responsible for your own learning, everything else falls into shape. So it was a pretty impressive conversation with my son at that time.
It is, because I say when we were in college, we were national debaters, and it was a skill that I used at home. It was a skill I used with 15-year-olds for 10 years, and I usually won because I was the judge. And so I just I think this is a great bill that Representative McLean, who has devoted 42 plus years of her life educating children, with speech and debate is a wonderful tribute.
And the reason we put it up first is because March 3rd is getting here very quickly, and we'd like to get it through.
March 3rd is Friday, I think, yes.
Yeah, we're not sure we'll get it through.
Hopefully we can get it through and have it passed by that time.
That would be nice.
Actually, Ms. Chair, if you want to, we could do that.
I think we can. That's what we're going to try to do.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else that really couldn't handle sitting out there without having a chance to speak to this bill? Okay, I don't see anybody. So we're going to close our public hearing on HCR 18. And we're going to open, because we got it done this time, a work session on HCR 18. So with that, I'll take a motion if you want to do that.
Chair Roblin, I move HCR 18 to the floor to be adopted by recommendation.
So Senator Lithicum moves HCR 18 to the floor with a be adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any overwhelming opposition? Seeing none, it passes. I always want to check to see if I can catch Senator Gelsinger.
Well, we could have debated it.
What? I'm carrying it?
No, I said I always like to make sure that you're paying attention. Your reaction let me know that you were paying attention.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it would have been an exercise because if you're on a debate team, sometimes you end up having to to make a case for something that you disagree with.
That's absolutely true. So, we need a carrier. Is there anybody that would love to carry besides myself? Or would you? You were a debater in high school. Do you want to carry the bill?
I would love to.
Okay. We'll have Senator Cruz carry the bill. With that, we're going to close our work session on HCR 18, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 274. Come on up, our good representatives, and we'll hear a short explanation of the bill. And just for the record, we have some bills we're going to introduce at the end. This is the last day bills can actually be introduced basically for free. So we're going to not do that till the end of the session. Just say somebody comes running in the door saying, you're the last people alive. Can you make us do that? So.
Senator Gelser's already here, so I'm not sure that's going to happen.
I'm really picked on today.
So whoever is going to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith-Warner, and I am the state representative from House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. Thank you all so much for having me here with my colleague, Representative Malmstrom, to talk about Senate Bill 274, the College Student Vaccine Education Bill. Senate Bill 274 would require Oregon colleges and universities that offer housing to provide students entering for the first time with information on vaccine-preventable diseases that commonly occur in individuals between the ages of 16 and 21. The information would include signs and symptoms of the diseases, how they're transmitted, recommendations from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, for prevention, and information on any national recommended recommended vaccines. Senate Bill 274 does not mandate vaccination, nor does it specify the form in which this information must be presented or distributed to students, and leaves that discretion entirely to the institution. So maybe it's by paper in a first aid packet, maybe it's on their website, maybe it's in some other way. We've given them lots of flexibility for how they want to do that. So as a mom and as a citizen, I am a great believer in public health in general and in vaccines specifically. Vaccine-preventable diseases take the lives of Oregonians every year, and young Oregonians are particularly vulnerable. Oregon, unfortunately, is well below the national average for adolescent immunization in a couple areas, specifically HPV, the human papillomavirus, and meningococcal. So for the year 2016, among kids 13 to 17, only 32.8% had been immunized for HPV and only 74% for meningitis. So, and from 2013 to 17, there were 36 campuses across the state of Oregon that had meningitis outbreaks. It's extremely contagious. It not only can lead to death, it can lead to long-term negative health impacts afterwards. So it's, and education is really the key to preventing the spread of contagious diseases. And the earlier we share this information with students, the more likely they are to be able to make responsible decisions about their health care. And the information required by this bill would be shared at a time when young people are going through times of transition and probably taking control of their own health and health care for the first time in their lives often. So this requirement can help ensure that they make well-informed decisions based on the most up-to-date data. Oregon is one of the few states, there are only 13, that do not have either a mandate for education or a requirement for vaccination of students residing in universities. And that's where, as we mentioned before, they're often most vulnerable to dangerous vaccine-preventable diseases. I believe that the threat posed by meningitis and other vaccine-preventable diseases are severe enough to Oregon's post-secondary students to ultimately require the vaccination of students who are living in those residential situations. And indeed, 22 states have mandated those types of vaccinations for college-age students in their states. However, that is not what this bill calls for. I believe that Senate Bill 274 does provide a critical first step toward a future vision in which Oregonian young adults are safe from vaccine-preventable diseases when they head off to live in residential universities. So I ask for your support of this bill today.
Thank you very much. We'll go on to our next distinguished guest, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Malmstrom. I'm the state representative from House District 27, representing Beaverton and parts of Southwest Portland. I'm a recently retired public health nurse, and I have three children who are all fairly recent graduates of Oregon universities. I come before you today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 274. Oregon does not require our universities to educate students on vaccine-preventable diseases. And with parents making the bulk of decisions for their children when they're younger, they end up coming to college without a firm understanding of many of public health issues such as vaccinations. But we have to change that. Senate Bill 274 would expand student access to this kind of information about their health care needs. Education is critical as our young adults form new communities on our college campuses. Students are constantly moving on and off campuses, taking classes, and participating in an active student at campus life. Ensuring that they know the risks of a contagious disease and all the different kinds that there are will help make sure that the outbreaks, when they occur, that they have the right information to protect themselves and the community. An entry educational requirement for all Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommended vaccines would be a strong step forward in student health and encouraging students to take control of their own health decisions. People who work in health policy often refer to this group of people as young invincibles. We know for a fact that they are not. Senate Bill 274 is not mandating any student to take any particular vaccine. We are all all we are doing is empowering them with the information that they need to make the best decision for themselves. 34 other states already have a similar education requirement. What I'm asking for here is that we make sure our students also get this kind of good information so they can make the best decisions for themselves. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from anyone on the committee? I see none. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
So next, I try to do this so that people are, Bob Snee, we'll have you come on up. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, other members of the committee, my name is Robert Snee, and I'm a member of Oregonians for Medical Freedom. And I'm here to speak on behalf of an opposition to this bill. It's not that we're opposed to education per se, but our members believe in the preserving the rights of the doctor-patient relationship and the right to informed consent. And looking at this bill as it's drafted and the proposed amendment that I've seen that's been posted, this bill is either unnecessary on one hand or on the other, inadequate on the other. There are many health issues that college-age students are approached with and dealing with that may be of more overriding concern than what the focus of this bill is meant to address. Nutrition, avoiding using drugs or abusing alcohol, being aware of date rape that occurs on that those settings, the need for vitamin D supplementation. These are all health issues that college student age students need to address with, and it's better that these issues are left to a discussion between the college age, the student, and their doctor, rather than having an institution, their college, providing additional requirements and educational requirements to provide for them. The proponents of the bill are focusing on the fact that this is a first step, and this bill does not currently mandate any new vaccines for college-age students. But I foresee that if this bill becomes law, 2 years from now, they'll be back here before you with an amendment to the bill mandating that these vaccines become part of the list of vaccines that are required to for college students to enable to attend any college. What this bill also fails to require is a full explanation of the laws that apply to college-age students and to all Oregonians in terms of there's no requirement that information in the about the existence of medical and non-medical exemptions to vaccines also be provided. So it's a one-sided information that's being forced upon the students that isn't a fair and balanced representation of what the law is that exists in the state.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Snee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Next, we'll have Lamar Wise, Allison Krause, and Pat L. from Lane County. Oh, thanks, Pat. Sometimes it's better to just say, get you up here, and then you can pronounce your own name the way it's supposed to be pronounced. Thank you. With that, whoever wants to start.
I can start real quick. My name is, for the record, my name is Lamar Wise, and I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill, mostly because the student body president at the University of Oregon, Quinn Haga, has requested us to do so. But also, the association as a whole is very supportive of this bill. One, because students are open to more information coming to them about vaccinations and diseases that they may need that vaccines for. And for folks who don't know, at the UVO there was a meningitis outbreak that did result in the death of a student and got many others very sick. And I was actually attending the UVO at the time when that happened, and I can tell you that it was not fun, and it was very scary for all the students that were involved, especially the students who were in close quarters with each other. So students in dorms and in apartments. So I'm here to represent their side of the story, saying that students will welcome information with open arms as to the dangers of certain diseases that are out there so that we can get the necessary information that we need to protect ourselves and protect our fellow students and to make sure that we are up to speed on whatever information is out there that we should be getting a hold of. So I just wanted to give that point of view and that insight and saying that we are in favor, again, of more information and making sure that that we know what we need to do to ensure that we're keeping safe.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Sorry. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Allison Krause, and I'm the Director of State Government Relations for Portland State University. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the 7 public universities. We support the -2 amendments, which address our financial concerns about this bill, and we'd also recommend that the Health Authority, the Oregon Health Authority, develop a handout that we could pass out for consistency among all 7. Thank you, and with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
That was fast. Chair Roblin, member of the committee, my name is Dr. Patrick Ludke. I'm the senior public health officer for Lane County. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. In May of 2012, a junior at the University of Oregon contracted bacterial meningitis. I was the health officer then. This person quickly became seriously ill and unfortunately died. Her death, which occurred on a Friday evening, resulted in a long weekend of mass prophylaxis, several hundred students requiring medication to ensure that this didn't spread any further. In December of 2014, University of Oregon had a large chickenpox outbreak. Many people think chickenpox is just a fever and a rash. Unfortunately, in people who are pregnant, first trimester, they can have a child that has unfortunate major malformations. If they get infected in the third trimester, the fetus can die. Given the rapid spread and the number of confirmed cases, there was a real concern for a large outbreak on the campus, especially because our immunization rate is quite low in Oregon. As such, a plan for vaccination of those at risk was quickly put into place and implemented, with Lane County Public Health helping the University of Oregon Student Health. In 2015, as mentioned here by the gentleman to my left, the University of Oregon was struck again by bacterial meningitis. This time, however, it spread throughout the student body. Ultimately, 7 persons were infected. 1 person died. Hundreds of exposed persons were treated with antibiotics to make sure that it didn't spread from their current exposure. And we also had 2 mass vaccination clinics where we gave out 29,100 doses of vaccine to ensure that it didn't spread beyond those 7 people. In late 2016 and now into 2017, if you paid attention to the papers the last few days, Oregon State University began its own meningitis outbreak. They're now up to 3 with the same bacteria that was in Lane County. At present, 3 students have been infected. Each is seriously ill. The current student is in the ICU. So I ask, what do all of these events have in common? They have several things in common, but certainly number one is they're all vaccine-preventable diseases. They're happening in busy students trying to navigate the unpredictable, chaotic years of their lives. I think that the years of late adolescence, and I still have 1 egg in the nest at my home, a teenager, the students are left with many choices at this time. And they're critical years, and they set some of their lifelong habits into stone during these years. Those habits can include tobacco use or drug use. They can include healthy diets and frequent exercise. They can include routine vaccination and perhaps even dental checkups if we do this right. For direction, I think looking at the sort of famous book called Nudge, it's an economics book called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness by Professors Thaler and Sunstein, lays out a pretty good argument that provides some direction. In short, it notes that despite good intentions, the chaotic and capricious nature of life means that people need a nudge on occasion to do the right things. They need nudges to save for retirement. They need nudges to sign up for their company IRA. They need nudges to choose organ donation and sign the back of their license. And yes, I think they need nudges to choose vaccination. Senate Bill 274 is a nudge. The -2 amendments I've read, and I think they make it an even better nudge. And I think that because this bill is not at least in my view as a public health officer, it's not a vaccination program. There's not excess cost. You don't have to create and staff and assess an ongoing vaccination clinic. I think it's worth supporting, and I believe it's a strong nudge that I support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you all for being here. Is there anyone else in the audience who is dying to get up here and be on TV? I don't see anyone up here wanting. So we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 274. And so people understand, in general, I don't have a public hearing and a work session on the same day because I like people to have a look it over. There are a couple amendments we should look at. We did that in the first case only because the 3rd of March is coming very soon, and we wanted to have that opportunity to have it in our deal. So with that, we're going to open our next public hearing on Senate Bill 653. Do you want to go down on this one?
I think we'll let the experts handle this one.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure you were offered.
Yes. Okay. But an explanation by staff would be helpful.
Okay. Explanation by staff. Thank
Chair
you.
Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 653 appropriates $504,300 to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for distribution to Umpqua Community College. It requires the distribution to be used for security patrols and an information technology network security specialist. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
Thank you, and welcome.
Thank you.
Your crowd left, but other than that.
They all told me before they left they were in support.
Okay, that's good to hear.
Honorable Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Committee on Education, I'm Deborah Thatcher, the president of Umpqua Community College in Roseburg. Thank you for your time today to speak to you about UCC's request for funding to continue in our recovery from the tragic events of October 1st, 2015. With me today is Susan Taylor, Executive Director of the UCC Foundation and author of many of the grants and requests that have been developed over the past year and a half. Susan was here the last time UCC testified and has been a constant advocate throughout our recovery process. I will speak briefly, and we will both be available to answer your questions. First, I'd like to sincerely thank you and the entire Oregon Legislature for everything that has been done to help UCC during this very difficult period. We're fortunate to have a legislature with compassionate members who recognized our need and came to our aid. Legislative funds so critically needed were used to pay for staff to help with threat management, IT security and network upgrades, security guards, installation of security equipment, and safety training. We would not be in the place we are today without the financial and non-financial assistance provided us from all across the state. The Oregon Legislature's leadership in this area was critical to our success and to ensuring our continued mission to educate the residents of Douglas County. I'd also like to thank Senator Jeff Cruz for being the chief sponsor of this request. Our college serves a community that is chiefly rural. Our students are primarily non-traditional. Single parents, displaced workers, veterans, and individuals underprepared for college. These students and the Douglas County community rely on UCC as the sole post-secondary institution in the county to meet all of their diverse needs. On October 1st, 2015, the unthinkable happened on our campus. At the end of that tragic day, our campus was forever changed by the horrible actions of a troubled individual. Lives were changed, futures were altered, families were torn apart. Our campus has worked hard since that terrible day to get back to our mission of educating students, but it has been a struggle. The devastation to our campus goes well beyond those directly impacted by this event. Even today, our campus community is struggling to get to a place we poignantly call our new normal. Right now, a year and a half after this pivotal event, there are still times that the campus community doesn't feel safe. Loud noises receive extra attention. Regular fire drills cause students, staff, and faculty to flinch in remembering that fateful day. And unfortunately, for a modest rural community college, there isn't enough money in our general fund to pay for all of the things that we couldn't have predicted we would need in order to restore community confidence and the feeling for all who come to UCC that our campus is a safe place. Today, I'm here to serve as the voice for students who have expressed some of their fears with me personally and have shared what we can do to help make them feel safe at UCC. Before October 1st, 2015, we didn't think about designing the school for the unexpected and the unthinkable. UCC is a very open campus that was planned and built more than 50 years ago, before these types of tragedies were, dare I say it, common. It's situated in a safe rural location. We didn't think about having our locks work from the inside with and without keys. We and many of our sister campuses didn't think about having an up-to-date public address system to be used in time of crisis. We didn't think about having visible security officers on campus that would both handle unusual issues and create a sense of safety and security for our students. We didn't know we would need a network security specialist to ensure our network and information systems could withstand surges in activity. Our campus has been lucky to have your support in setting many of these safety and security measures in place. When Susan and UCC's interim president, Dr. Walter Nolte, were here last year, they talked about the process of creating a resilient campus and how UCC is moving toward recovery. They also provided the committee a preview of services that may need to be extended into the 17-19 biennium, identifying five positions for extended funding. Since their testimony, in an effort to be good stewards of public funds, our team has re-examined our progress and needs, and as a result, we have removed one position from that forecast of needs for the next biennium. Our request today is for two items that are crucial for our campus and items for which we cannot get funding from any other source. We are asking you today to move forward a request for three full-time campus security patrols and an IT network system security specialist. We've received funding from several sources since 2015 and have explored multiple possibilities of funding for these two items. In fact, before we developed this request, we exhausted every other avenue we could. To date, we've received funding from the U.S. Department of Education, U.S. Department of Justice, other grants, donations, insurance reimbursement, and subawards in partnership with other agencies. Some of the things that were funded by these other sources are recovery-related positions, contractual services, and equipment and supplies such as property damage repair, surveillance equipment, and a 15-month lease on three temporary modular buildings for displaced staff and students from that affected building. But even with all of this assistance, our campus still has a few needs to reach a place where we feel fully functional. The security personnel are agents who are needed to patrol our campus and off-site locations. The three full-time equivalent positions provide protection of our property and college community. They are a visible, uniform presence on campus, providing a real feeling of safety and security for the entire campus community. They supervise our surveillance cameras and dispatch services, oversee our security systems, and coordinate with the Douglas County Sheriff's Office and other law enforcement services on behalf of UCC. These positions bring great peace of mind to our students and staff. In preparation for this testimony, I reached out to Jantine Bunce, peer mentor and president of the UCC chapter of the Honor Society, Phi Theta Kappa, to ask her about our student body's perspective on having security personnel on campus. Here are her words. Statistically, the shooting should have never happened here. Statistically, a shooting will never happen here again. However, our new reality is that a tragic shooting did occur, and that has caused a lingering anxiety for many students. The presence of security personnel on campus lessens that anxiety. Because we know help is just around the corner, we come to class and get involved on campus at a much higher level than we would have if we didn't have the constant presence of the guards. The request for an IT network systems security specialist is critical for our campus. Our systems were both overburdened and taxed heavily by the impact of this event. During the day of and the day after the event, our website had over 59,000 hits and was actually taken offline for some time. This event exposed the need for both shoring up our network and including IT as an integral part of our security measures and planning. Currently, every position in the college's information technology department that focuses on network infrastructure and system support is a single point of failure. Due to our limited budget and minimal staffing, Umpqua needs an additional person to assist with network infrastructure and security systems, planning, implementation, updates, and upgrades. This position is vital in providing support to achieve college security goals. Specifically, this position would implement a fiber system upgrade as a part of the campus safety and security plan, ensure that our system is secure, and serve as a resource for our security measures. In preparation for this testimony, I reached out to our head of IT, Dan Yoder, to explain why this position is so critical to the safety and security of our entire campus system. He said, "This position is a key component of our ability to accomplish the network infrastructure work currently in progress, thanks to legislative funding. It will help us successfully complete the implementation of network security protocols and monitoring of added security and messaging systems so that our permanent staff will be able to take over as we move into the future. These are complex systems with complex integrations and requirements, so this position will be needed for an additional 2 years to ensure the full training and cross-training of permanent staff. To summarize, we are here to make a limited request for funding of four crucial positions to transition UCC to a stable position by the end of this biennium. After the 2017-2019 biennium, we anticipate greater stability and are confident that the services provided by these positions will either no longer be needed or will be able to be paid out of our general fund. We sincerely appreciate your time and attention to our presentation and ask that you consider moving this request forward. Thank you.
Thank you. You get to go next, if you want to say anything.
I'm only here for questions.
Okay. So, questions?
No, but maybe a comment.
Comment, Senator, okay. Senator Cruz.
I am familiar with Umpqua College from way before you two were even around. All community colleges were developed organically in the state. It's an amazing network. I can remember when Umpqua Community College was called UCLA. It was Umpqua College late afternoon because the classes were held at Roseburg High School after the high school was done with its business for the day. That was the start. Then they got a very generous gift of the land where the college is currently located. It's a wonderful setting. I mean, but it is also very spread out. And security is definitely an issue because, I mean, if somebody really wanted to do bad things, they could float down the river and come up there and there would be, you know, I mean, it's just where it is. And we have actually enjoyed the setting and we just do want to make it safe. I would also say that the response after the event by the governor and the agencies of this state were amazingly prompt and amazingly helpful. And I was involved in most of those phone calls and meetings as well. And we'll be forever grateful for the response, not just of government, but, you know, fire departments and EMTs and a whole bunch of folks from all over the state who showed up in Roseburg to help us deal with that. And quite honestly, we're also very grateful that we were able to do a redo of the building where that event happened. That was critical too, just to remove the stain. This is, I think, a very reasonable request to kind of help us finish transitioning into, you say a new normal, but I think eventually we'll get back to a real normal. I truly believe that. But these things take time. They take a lot of time. And, you know, the community of Douglas County has been there with everything that we can do to help. But see, another part of our problem here is the fact that we are a timber-dependent county who does not have the revenue sources we used to. So, you know, if this was happening 20 years ago, you know, security could have been handled by the sheriff's office. But at this point, our local law enforcement is having enough trouble just covering the things that they have to, because Douglas County is a big county, and there's a lot of ground to cover. And so we cannot depend on local law enforcement to do everything that at one point in time they could have done. So it's kind of, a lot of things are happening, unfortunately, all at the same time. And this request, I think, I think you're right, this request will do a lot to make people feel safe again and help us restore the campus to the normal situation it was. And you're right. I think every community college you go to, the mix of students is going to be different. But, you know, not only are we a timber-dependent county, but we're also a county with about 20% unemployment. And we've got a lot of people that are trying to find a new pathway. And the college is that pathway. So it needs to be an inviting atmosphere. And this request, I think, is absolutely appropriate. And I'm hoping that relatively soon, Mr. Chair, we'll schedule it for a work session and send it to Ways and Means, where you will see it again on the subcommittee.
So any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Thank you for coming all this way. Congratulations on the job.
Thank you. And you know, it's an interesting, if I may say so. Sure. I had students, especially students, but other people asked me, why in the world would I come here? I came from across the country, and it was several months after the shooting. And it was just by the things you were talking about, Senator, the support of the community, the outpouring of care, the support from from Salem, amazing. And so it was easy. It was an easy decision to come to a place where people pulled together for the whole healing process. And I appreciate your understanding that the recovery isn't a short-term thing, and especially with the challenges that we have economically in the county. But I do thank you very much. It's a wonderful campus, very much.
And you know, one of the things we talk about is you know, the students in high schools being able to get college credits. Umpqua is huge in that, and you know, this community college is an absolutely central part of our culture in Douglas County, and I'm very proud of the work they have done, and we will continue.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So I don't see a real large crowd, but is there anybody up there that would love to come up and testify on this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 653.
Well, Ms. Chair, before they leave, tell my ex-wife that I said good things, okay? She's on the board,
yeah.
So okay.
And now we will open.
Kind of has some humor occasionally.
I agree.
Okay.
a public hearing on House Bill 2257.
I can't understand why that marriage ended.
Yeah, exactly. No way at all to know how that would happen.
Shall we discuss?
So we'll have a short explanation of the bill, and then Jan and Jeremy can come on up.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2257 allows the Oregon Department of Education to waive fees for instructional materials that are proposed for review and adoption by the State Board of Education if the instructional materials are in the public domain or have been released under an intellectual property license permitting free use.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Jan McComb from the Oregon Department of Education, and with me is Jeremy Wirtz. He is the department's instructional materials coordinator, and as you can tell by the full room, it's a very controversial measure. We're here to ask you to support House Bill 2257. It's one of the agency's bills. The bill was drafted at the request of the instructional materials review staff in the Department of Education. Those staffers are in charge of the department's instructional materials review and adoption process. As you know, the State Board of Education approves a list of instructional materials for school districts to use. In order to develop this list, publishers submit their materials to the department, and staff and teams of teachers review the materials to see whether they align with state standards. School districts don't have to adopt from the list, but if they don't, the districts must do a full evaluation to determine alignment with standards, and most of the smaller districts just don't have the capacity and staff to do this. State law requires the department to charge a fee equal to the retail price, or $50, whichever is greater, for each item per grade of instructional materials submitted. These days, there are more open educational resources that are available for free and online. These are created by teachers and nonprofits. Recently, the U.S. Department of Education launched an initiative that encouraged school districts to use, develop, and share high-quality open education resources. However, because we have to charge a fee and because these entities do not make a profit, they're not incentivized to submit these materials to the department to be added to the list of approved materials. Jeremy, you want to talk about?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and some members of the Senate Committee on Education. For the record, my name is Jeremy Wirtz. I'm with the Oregon Department of Education. For example, school teachers, science specifically, in Forest Grove and Beaverton developed a science curriculum. Three school districts, Hillsboro, Gresham, and North Bend would like to use these. But because of the fee requirement, the districts will be forced to evaluate the curriculum themselves and independently adopt. And that's a lot of work.
So, Mr. Chair, as a result, most school districts aren't able to take advantage of a lot of wonderful free resources that are out there and make learning more fun and interactive. House Bill 2257 allows the State Board of Education to waive the fee and place more open source materials on the list of approved instructional materials, and this will expand materials available to school districts at no cost to them. I ask your support for House Bill 2257.
Thank you. Any questions? I guess my question is, the fee is based on the actual cost of the material, right?
It's Chair Roblin, members of the committee, it's $50 or the cost of the material, whichever is greater.
Okay. So there is a charge no matter what. There isn't a way to get by. Why don't you say 100% charge of the cost of the materials? And, no, I'm just kidding. So, and a lot of this is open source material. A lot of it is other stuff that's just been produced out there that, in whatever format, but none of it is available with your okay, which means they have to go through the whole process. That's what I'm understanding, right? Okay. As more and more material gets there, that doesn't make a lot of sense. We have companies that are actually doing it. I know that Apple has materials that are out there that they don't charge for. A bunch of the textbook people have materials that don't. So I guess if you approve their textbook, that material comes with it. That works out. It's when it's separate from a regular text that they're going to be having approved. Is that true or not?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, it's any instructional materials.
Oh, any, okay. So if it's different from the textbook, it has to have go through the process.
It's a broader term.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We're going to close our public hearing on... Oh. Morgan, did you want to come up and testify on this? Oh, okay. Just checking out if anybody else...
I think he does.
I thought it looked like he did.
He looks like he does.
Yeah. So we're going to close our public hearing.
This woke him up.
I know. That's why I called his name. 2257. We will close that public hearing. We have some bills that people have asked us to introduce as committee bills. And again, I like to make sure that everybody understands introducing bills as committee bills is a process by which the bills get introduced so that they can go through the process. We don't expect these necessarily to come back to the Education Committee. We don't have, in voting to introduce them, there is no expectation that we're going to vote for them, that we like them, or that we don't like them. It just means that we're letting them go into the process as a committee bill. So with that, Senator Lithcomb, do you wish to make a...
Sure. Certainly, Chair Roblin, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. First up, we have LC 3580, which is dated February 28th. Next, LC 1994, which is dated February 24th, followed by LC 3363, dated February 24th, and lastly, LC 3541, dated 221, February 21st.
Let's see if I got all these right. So, Senator Lithgow moves that we introduce LC 3580, February 28th, 17, LC 1994, date 2/24/17, LC 3363, date 2/24, introduction, and LC 3541 with an introduction date of 2/21/17. Is there any discussion on any of these bills for introduction?
I don't know, 1994, that wasn't a very good year, so
good book. Yeah. Or 84, I guess it was, wasn't it? Other questions? I don't see anyone, and I see that you were looking very intently at your screen, so it must have been you were looking them all over. So
to make sure that they were all in there. Mr. Chair, if
yes.
They are introduced by the Senate Education Committee, does it make it more likely that they will be assigned to the Senate Education Committee as opposed to the Senate Human Services Committee?
I would like to say yes, but I don't believe that to be the case. No. They decide what they want to do with them.
I just think they would all be great for the Senate Education Committee.
I think she has something to do with some of these.
Might have.
That's just a guess.
Okay. So any more discussion on the introduction of these bills? If not, is there anyone in opposition of the bills being introduced without any knowledge that we agree or disagree with any of them? Seeing none, that has been approved, and these bills, I have to sign them, and then we're on its way. We're going to close the work session on the introduction of bills. And I don't think there's any more things coming to us, so we will adjourn. And before a couple of the people who are walking out now are walking out, I'd love to talk to them after the meeting, just for a second. To talk to them after the meeting, just for a second. Walking out now are walking out. I'd love